Be good.
Well, hey there, friends and strangers. Welcome to the Monkey Tooth Podcast. It is your pal, Andrew, bringing you a special episode of the show with my friend, Tal Ruspoli. Tal is one of those people that you could just pick any adjective with a positive connotation, and it's probably right. I mean, he's just the most enthusiastic, open-hearted, open-minded, intelligent, well-rounded people was doing a very, very cool thing with a whole town here in Bombay Beach, which is where I am currently. I'm in Bombay Beach, California, on the Salton Sea. You should look it up if you don't know where it is, so you get a sense of the map while he's talking about this place. He gives a really great historical context for what this place is and for the project that he's working on, the Bombay Beach Biennale, which is a fascinating thing to be around. I've been talking to so many creative and just all around, I don't know, ambitious people. I've got some really great conversations recorded and many more to come. I'll be sharing those with you throughout the next bunch of weeks. But yeah, enjoy this one with Tal. I certainly did, and it's been great to see him. I haven't been here in 5 years, so it's really wonderful to see the change in this town, the evolution of this this work, this body of work that Tao and his partners are putting together. So, yeah, give it a look. And go watch some of Tao's films. Tao, in addition to being a wrangler and encourager of art, is also a very sensitive and creative filmmaker. He's being in the world, did a great series of documentary on flamenco guitar. He's made some narrative films. Just got a good body of work. So I'll put some links up in the show notes. And until next time, hope you enjoy this episode. Do fun and interesting things, and we'll see you next time.
The sun is rising over Bombay Beach, and I'm about to do a podcast with my old friend Andrew Couch. He's interviewing me.
It's a strong word, interview.
And outside is Zigzag Plaza, which is one of the more ambitious projects to date in Bombay. And we're inside a Sprinter van, which has been set up to be a beautiful, wonderfully smelling, warm, cozy, high-tech audio recording studio.
Good morning.
Good morning. Oh my God, you and Pele look great there. Picture
there. Yeah, Pele has sat through, 100 podcasts easily, and he just hardly ever barks. He probably will today now that I've said that. But.
Well, we got a warm cup of coffee.
Yeah, man.
We have the sun on our right. We have Zigzag Plaza on our left. Zigzag Plaza is one, the Lower East Side of Bombay Beach. Yeah. My little neck of the woods here. We have a kind of an unofficial, unstated, competitive spirit between the three founders, the three co-founders, Stefan Ashkenazi, Lily Johnson White, and I. And we have our little corners of town, and we try and I think, impress each other in the world with what we do each year.
How do they feel about being beaten so badly?
Not at all. You haven't been over there.
No, I know. It's incredible.
And Stefan is bringing some big surprises this year, so I'm really excited.
Yeah. They're such talented people, man. I mean, with really incredible vision. And one thing I like about the three of you is that, you know, not one of you is doing this by yourself. It's not like it's just Tao's project or Stefan's project. It's you're hyping and promoting, and not even promoting is a weird word. You're empowering all these other artists. And
we have 150 submitted artists this year. And then we have to mention Dulcinea, who's producing the whole thing. She's my partner and got involved in the Biennale two, 3 years ago. We're talking about the Bombay Beach Biennale.
We are talking about the Bombay Beach Biennale.
If anyone is unaware. And I think, it's interesting because it's both like this very discreet thing. We don't publicize it anywhere. We don't sell tickets. We don't publish the dates anywhere. And yet it's become a thing that people, oh, there he goes.
There's a dog walking on the levee. It's okay.
And it's become a thing that people seem to know about and come to and gravitate towards. And it's this kind of very fragile and beautiful little organism.
It is funny, fragile. It's funny you say that because when I walk around, like, I haven't, for context, anybody listening, I haven't been here for 5 years. And the changes that you've been able to make in the 5 years since I was last here, and your partners as well, it's incredible. I mean, this town, it's all the things you kind of told me you wanted to have happen early on, you know, that you wanted to invigorate this town, you wanted to raise awareness of the plight of this town, of the sea. But it also has this weird kind of fragility to it, because it seems like it could go off the rails in a way, you know, like that there's always some weird corrupting influence.
We have a Sarah Larson outside who I told that you had coffee. I didn't tell her that we were podcasting because I didn't know we were podcasting. We were just wonderfully interrupted by one of the 150 great artists here.
Oh, yeah.
And when I say artist, I say it expansively because it's musicians, it's theater.
Yeah.
It's photography, it's large-scale installations.
It's everything. Film. I was helping your buddy yesterday try to work out a screen to screen a film that he's going to show here for the first time. Is that?
I guess, yeah. Maybe for the second time. It's a new cut, I think. Yeah. He had already a cut last year.
Nice.
But, so the fragility is due to the fact that, I mean, we're in a very small town. It's contained in this tiny little square that you wouldn't, it doesn't make any sense because you're in the open desert. So usually things, especially in the States, like there's not really the concept of a village or a town that's contained within walls as you have in Europe. Right. So you get this tendency to sprawl.
Yeah.
And everyone wants to just kind of, and so you have these amorphous places, whereas Bombay Beach is absurdly amorphous, is that a word?
Quite amorphous.
It's just defined by these like straight lines.
Totally.
It's a square on the shore of this, you know, surreal, catastrophic,
accidental
lake. or sea, actually.
Sea, yeah.
It actually, it's called the Salton Sea, and it's not just a poetic use of the word sea. I think it's because it's salty and it has no inlets.
Yeah, and it's an ancient seabed.
And it's an ancient seabed.
It was a seabed of millions of years ago.
Yeah.
Part of the reason why it's so salty is that right?
No, so it's salty because of there's salt in the ground.
Right.
So because it's filled with Colorado River water. Mm-hmm. And it's an ancient, I think I've also heard it as a lake bed. I don't know the exact difference. But basically, the Colorado River flows through five states and makes its way to the Sea of Cortez between Baja and Mexico, but not one drop falls into the sea. All that water is like, you know, fought over and partitioned to all the tens of millions of people who use it, and for agriculture and for domestic use. And so you have this delta, it looks like a kind of the Nile almost. Like if you look at a map, it's desert, and then it's like this sudden like burst of green. And in the early 1900s, they were basically damming the Colorado River to redirect it for the farming. And there was a breach in one of these dams, and all of a sudden, the entire contents of the Colorado River spilled into this ancient riverbed, which had lakebed, seabed, whatever it is, which had filled naturally in the past. So it's not entirely unnatural, but this last time, they say it's the only accident you can see from space, and basically, you know, for 3 years, the entire contents of the Colorado River spilled into this low bed, and it filled it up, and it made what is still today the largest body of water in California, even though most people don't know it exists.
Right, right. How is that not the sign on the front of the town, like, the only accident you can see from space? It's got to the, like, Ripley's Believe It or Not sort of thing. Well, the corrupting influence, I guess I'm thinking about specifically now, as far as, like, what would lend it fragility, more vulnerability, is this, the lithium aspect of it, now that they've discovered.
Yeah, that's a spoiler alert. There was a lot of strange history in between. First of all, when this accident happened, they could have just let it dry up, but instead there was all these kind of, now in retrospect, hubristic, opportunistic people who said, well, look, we could have like Palm Springs with water. We could have like the best of the desert and the sea. And what if we build little towns around it and have fishing and boating and, you know, just recreation of all kinds, and we'll build marinas and yacht clubs, and in the 50s, and then they have to keep it full, but they have all this agriculture around it. So they said, we could just like have excess water from the agriculture, keep it full, agricultural runoff with all of those chemicals and everything that it comes with. So you have that, and then you have the salt that's in the ground, and yeah, it's very hot here in the summer, especially the, like 120s. That's like Death Valley. We're also below sea level. We're 230 feet below sea level. So as the water would evaporate, there's a little bit of salt already and minerals, obviously, in the Colorado water. And as it evaporates, that concentration of salt lifts each year, basically. And then the salt from the ground goes into it. Like if you look here, it's like, that you can see the salt in the dirt,
yeah,
in the clay,
which is a strange thing. For whatever reason, I would not associate salt and clay.
Yeah,
I don't know.
But it worked for a while. Like, what could possibly go wrong, right?
Right.
Everything went wrong. But in the 90s, we had in the 90s. All of a sudden, they stocked it with fish, so there would be fishing. So there was like corvina and tilapia, which reproduced at alarming rates. So you would get, and then the heat and the salt and the lack of like flow and oxygenation of the water caused the fish to die, but they were reproducing even faster than they were dying. So you'd get days in the 90s where like 9 million fish could die in a day, and like, they'd all wash ashore. And if you Google like salt and sea fish die-offs, you can see like dead fish as far as the eye can see. I'm literally, millions of fish are just swarmed, you know, just kind of just washed up ashore. And so all the smell that this caused most people, but not all, to evacuate these little towns. So Bombay Beach, which had a population of like 2,500 or 3,000 in its heyday, it's, you know, I counted about 1,050 lots in town. Bombay Beach went from this like thriving little fun beach town to this weird, like desolate quasi ghost town.
Yeah.
And so I saw a book by Kim Stringfellow called Greetings from the Salton Sea or something. And I was in a bookstore and I see this like rotting Airstream trailer on the cover of a, you know, it's like an orange toxic looking liquid. And I'm like, Airstreams and desert, I love all these things. And then like the idea of this kind of weirdly, this weird kind of marginal world that I couldn't believe I'd never heard of. So I got in my car and I drove the 3 hours from LA, and I started circling the lake. And when you get to the northeastern side, it says, welcome to North Shore. And then it says Mecca. In North Shore, you see like the International Banana Museum, which is like the world's largest collection of banana related memorabilia. And then it's just open desert on your left and this weird placid body of water on your right. Very surreal. often like it you know, like it disappears, the horizon of it disappears. You can't see the other side sometimes. It's like just very like this haze. It's wonderfully weird and majestic. And so you think you're done seeing man-made things. You just see the lake on the right and the desert on your left, and suddenly it's just open desert. And then there's a sign that says Bombay Beach, 8 miles. Yes. And I'm like, what the fuck is Bombay Beach, you know? And I arrived, this was in 2008. Mm. And I just see like every house is like an abandoned trailer piled with trash. I mean, it was very 10 times more far gone than what you see today.
Oh, yeah.
And there was no art, like not even the thought of an art piece, not even not even like a photo on a wall. And you just like, the only art that you would see is like people would come here to kind of engage in like ruin porn, or like, you know, like do it as a backdrop of a music video. Yeah. Very cliche. I did it myself. I came and shot a music video here. Yeah. But it was, and I immediately like started thinking, it's sad that like already this place has just been fucked by the world in so many ways. And now like hipsters from LA are coming and just extracting, and they don't even stay. There's nothing in the town to show for the creativity that it's still inspiring.
Yeah.
Because it was a magical place. You could feel this kind of like magic in the air. But I couldn't believe that there was no place to sleep, no Airbnb, no motel, only this one bar called the Ski Inn, which seems absurd until you realize they used to water ski up to it. So, so I was married at the time, and I went back to my wife and I said, this place is amazing. And there's like for sale signs on a lot of the lots. And I looked it up, and you know, lots are like $500. Yeah. You can buy a house that's ready to move into for like $10,000. Nobody wants to buy them. Like, let's get one. And she was like, what?
What's wrong?
Why on earth would anyone want a house in that shithole? You know, like it was just like considered this horrible place, and it smelled bad, and there's flies, and it just like next to an open sewer. Some people like it felt like at the time, because also the water came up to the town, and where it would sit stagnant, and there would just, it was like basically a cesspool.
Yeah,
and you'd see like remnants also of like, another weird part of the history is that they would practice for dropping the bomb on Nagasaki here, Fat Man. Mm-hmm. And so there's like still like 5 dummy bombs, and they still do like military bombing tests on the ranges here, the Chocolate Mountains. So you'll hear bombs every once in a while going off. And like supposedly in World War II, they were doing all these airplane like practice runs, and sometimes the planes would crash, and there's like remnants of like 12 World War II soldiers still inside this lake, you know, in the lake supposedly, and there's planes. And so anyway, and then the town would flood. That was another reason why so the farmers had to, in the early 1900s, they had to say how much water they thought they would need. And they were told by, you know, the people in power, like, you're never going to be able to up the amount.
Right.
So overestimate what you're going to need. And to this day, the Imperial Valley gets more water like per capita than anywhere else along the Colorado River, because at the time there wasn't as fought over. Right. And so basically, all the farmers overestimated their water needs, and all the excess water that they had. What's this?
Speaking of water, you have some behind you. I poured you a cup.
Okay, no, it's okay. I'm good with my coffee. It's mostly water.
As soon as you say water here, it makes me immediately want to drink, because it's so dry. So please, sorry, the water rights, they had overestimated. The
water rights. Yeah, so they overestimated the water rights, the water they would need. And then all the excess water, they would just turn on the taps and it would flood into the Salton Sea. So what would happen is actually the sea would flood outside of its borders. And Bombay Beach, being right on the border of it, would just get flooded. And the lower part of the town, which is even lower than the sea, which is already below sea level, would just get completely devastated. And so rather than leave, as they were encouraged to do, the town folk like got together and built this giant berm, which still surrounds the town. So now not only are you like, one of the absurdities of this place is that you You're next to this gorgeous body of water, which is now like no longer a cesspool. It's also like receded. I'll explain that in a minute, but we can't see it.
Yeah.
So it's like this absurd thing where we're like underground. We're like mole people.
Yeah.
So now the goal is to get up high.
Yeah. Which you've done beautifully every time I see something about this place, it's you going up somewhere, yeah. You know.
I built a giant egg.
Yeah, double-decker bus,
the Galabrat.
Yeah.
No, the goal is to get up. And my dream is that it becomes like ancient Rome, where we preserve the ruins underneath, and then you build up. So if you go to Rome, like there's the Renaissance buildings are on top of the ancient Roman buildings, and the like 19th century buildings are on top of that. And sometimes you'll see in one building, you can see like the foundation is ancient. And then the first two stories are like medieval, and then it's Renaissance, and then it's like modern.
Right. The foundation is Airstream trailer. The walls are now.
Yeah. Yeah.
3D printed. Yeah. Well, it's your vision, because you explained a lot of this to me early when we first met. I met you right before your birthday. I met you here at the Ski Inn, and within 5 minutes of coming into this van, you invited us to your birthday party. In your house in Yucca Valley, mm-hmm. And you laid out the vision for this festival. You know, in your idea, it was more than just a festival.
It's not a festival. Yeah, we don't usually use that word.
It's a weird word
associated with it.
Yeah, but it is a celebration of art. It's a celebration of the weirdness of this town.
Yeah,
the very things that you talked about, the hubris of the developers putting in yacht clubs and all this shit. You guys now do in a tongue-in-cheek way that's like. I mean, it's funny and ironic, but it's also useful, and it's honoring what this place is, and saying, okay, it's fine that it's weird and fucked up. We're going to work with it and make the best of it. So I really like what you did with your vision there to like, I see this thing, I see the decay, I see this canvas to paint on and to build on top of ruins, and the way that it's working. I mean, there are people here that are independent of the Biennale that have moved here, and they just love it because of what it's become. And
yeah, I mean, so this is an unpopular opinion probably, but I think the higher the population density we can achieve, the better in a way. Like, I would love to see the town go back to having 2,500 people as long as it's the right weird enough people.
Yeah.
I think that right now the fight is against like normalization. Cause so to finish the story of the kind of arc of the Salton Sea is that in 2017, so in 2016, we started the Bombay Beach Biennale, which was the idea was to bring unexpectedly high art and philosophy, ballet, opera, academic philosophy conference, large scale installations, the photography exhibits, you know, art by recognized artists and unknown artists. Right. But the idea would be that the art would be cumulative. So unlike, you know, something like Burning Man where, you know, it just disappears every year, that like lends to a difficulty in planting roots, which is beautiful. I love the mandala kind of metaphor of Burning Man.
Right.
But the idea here is that, you know, people could buy lots and then make art, and we, you know, we don't tell people what to do, but we ask that it be as permanent as possible in a, you know, a universe that permanence is an illusion, and we're all going to be faced with heat death and, but at least
archival,
at least a fighting the ephemerality of the tendency towards ephemerality. So in 2016. Was the first Biennale. Stefan, Lily, and I came together, called it Year Zero, because we thought like year one would be too presumptuous. We didn't know if it was going to actually work. And then in 2017, lo and behold, the water that was being used, the agricultural excess water that was being used to keep the sea full, was sold to San Diego. And San Diego has a huge water, you know, needs as it's growing, and all these, we were speaking of sprawl earlier, like the suburban sprawl and of all of the Southern California cities requires more and more water. And so the water that was being used to fill the sea. So now the sea started to evaporate. And it's not, there's not no water being put in, so it's not going to completely dry up, but year after year, it shrinks. Like, they used to put like a million acre feet. Water's measured in acre feet, which is like an acre, 150.
Yeah.
So they used to put a million acre feet a year.
Wow.
And I understand the politically why, like, the water's like very scarce. Why would we be spilling it into this, like, you know, cesspool?
Hole in the ground.
That's unnatural. But the thing is that the sea had become one of the most important like stops for migratory birds.
Yeah.
Millions of birds that have like had all of their other wetlands like developed, that had nowhere left to eat. Like, it's already like, I don't know, like half the birds that make their migration die because they don't have enough fish anymore. Wow. And so the Salton Sea had become, from this accident, into a very important watering hole, mm-hmm. and feeding place for all these like many species of birds. People used to come and bird watch here, like amazing pelicans and the egrets and like all sorts of really beautiful birds.
Yeah.
So it's devastating now because the fish have all died, which, and the water's receded, which for Bombay Beach is great because it doesn't smell bad. You don't have this like flooding. The water is like far away. We have this beautiful place for art now.
Yeah.
So it makes it more habitable, but it's a fucking disaster again, new kind of disaster now.
Yeah.
So, and where there was too much water, not enough water. I like to say that Bombay Beach is like practice for everything that can go wrong in the world has. You know, like environmental catastrophe, income inequality, joblessness, global warming, all of these things. We haven't had war here yet.
Yeah.
Knock on wood.
Not much.
No nuclear fallout.
Yeah.
But we have the symbol of that with the like nuclear bomb shells that are in the sea. It just occurred to me.
Yeah, we'll practice here and drop it elsewhere.
And now the Martians have landed too. I have to tell that story.
Yes.
In fact, I should detour into that. That's a really good story. I don't even think I've told you this story because this happened after you. Did you meet Friedman?
Yeah. He's been on this very program.
Oh, he has been.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful.
I gave him a ride to his mom's house in this van.
Amazing, amazing.
Love Friedman. Can't wait to see him.
So the last time you came was the first Mars?
The Mars was an idea.
Was an idea.
Yeah. Well,
have you been out there this time yet?
Not yet.
You got to go before they start disassembling it.
They take it apart every year.
That's what's crazy.
Oh my God.
They build this massive thing. So another little story, but it's a good one. In 2001, I was living in a converted school bus that I bought on eBay. I'd graduated from college and I wanted to find a way to make films outside of the Hollywood system. Digital video was new. I was excited about nomadism and, you know, this like kind of van life phenomenon, which didn't quite exist yet. I mean, it existed obviously in different iterations through different eras, but as we know it now. So I bought an old school bus on eBay and took all the seats out, and we put three digital video editing stations in it. And I had a famous graffiti artist in LA paint the outside, and it said Los Angeles Filmmakers Cooperative. And for 2 years, I lived in this bus and we would travel around. There was three of us. It's a funny recurring theme. we would travel around and make films with artists who were used to working in other media. So our goal was to find painters, poets, musicians, and say, look, there's this new medium called digital video, and it used to take, you know, thousands of dollars to make a movie. Now you can make a movie for just the price of a digital videotape, which is $10 or something. And we had a quote by Jean Cocteau written on the side of the bus, and it said, film will only become art when its materials are as inexpensive as pencil and paper.
I love that.
And so we thought, like, we're almost there. And we also would like teach workshops and like with schools. And then someone told me, one of my partners at the time, Alfonso, told me there was this thing called Burning Man that he had heard of, or he had gone once before, I can't remember. And we got to go check it out. And so we went in 2001, and I was like, holy shit, 25,000 like-minded individuals who are interested in the intersection of art and technology and nomadic living and working outside the system. And so this was really cool. And so after Burning Man, we spent like a few months in Northern California, Mendocino, all these wonderful little towns up there, Point Arena, Fort Bragg, and looking for artists, meeting great artists. September 11th happened. It was just amazing, weird moment in history. And then we went back to LA. My friend, one of the partners, this eccentric old artist who had made money in real estate in the 60s buying buildings in Venice Beach that were like run down old buildings that he would fix up. And like he was doing a really cool kind of creative real estate. He was a big influence on me. Roger Mono Webster. He had like 7-inch long fingernails.
Oh, wow.
And he was like taking digital video photos, like one of the first people to do this, and like was taking like, he had a collection of hundreds of thousands of photos every day. He would be shooting these pictures. And so he was kind of like a kind of older mentor to us. And he was like cross-dressing and just a really interesting, weird character,
yeah.
Really very smart. And so he owned the building behind the Rose Cafe in Venice Beach, which is now, Google. Ironically.
So he did fine. He did fine.
Yeah. And yeah, they, but so he let me park the bus in the parking lot of the, it was called the Gas Company building. And so I was living in the back of the bus and I, and there was a journalist from the Guardian newspaper who had wrote an article about us called like the United States first mobile anarchist digital video studio, film studio on wheels. It was a great little moment. And I was living in the bus. Alfonso and Mona were nearby. And the idea was to kind of keep meeting artists and cultivate this like outsider way of approaching filmmaking. And so I put flyers all around town that said, if you want to meet filmmakers who want to work outside the Hollywood system, come to the parking lot of the Rose Cafe at 6 p.m. on Tuesdays and chat with us. So one day this guy shows up, he walks in the door, and I frankly thought he was a homeless guy from the boardwalk. He had no shoes on. He was wearing like a Mexican blanket. He had a really long, straggly beard. He had dreadlocks. He would chant randomly. And he just like sat cross-legged during our little meetup. And afterwards, he started asking very pointed questions like, why, like, where did you get the money for this equipment? And do you have 501c3 status? And do you want to have dinner? And I was like, I'm trying to be really inclusive. And I'm like, okay, yeah, let's go for a walk. We're going to go have some tacos up the street. So we're walking up the street. And finally, I'm like, why are you asking me all this? What's your deal? And he says, well, I started a tech company a few years ago and I sold it and I made many millions of dollars. And now I just wander the earth helping people like you who are doing things that are interesting. And what do you need? And I was like thinking fast on my feet. And I was like, well, I'm sleeping in this bus that has like my dirty socks on, you know, on the ground while I'm trying to run a filmmakers collective out of it. What I need is a building.
Yeah.
So Freeman decides to rent a building in Venice on Venice Boulevard, which was an old powerhouse. And Ray Bradbury had grown up there because his father worked for Southern California Edison, and he wrote like the Martian Chronicles in the like guest house of this powerhouse building. And Freeman decides to stop wandering the earth for a while, and we partner up to create the Los Angeles Filmmakers Cooperative home base in Venice Beach. But the problem was that the building was completely empty, and it was a big wide open space. So Freeman says, why don't we buy pallet racks from, you know, that they use at like Costco or, you know, like big box stores to like, you know, stack merchandise. And why don't we create like cubbies and we'll invite people to come in and, you know, occupy the space, and they can we can have like a kind of community center, you know, for artists. So cut to like a couple months later, we have this like thriving little kind of hub of like a kind of hippie community art making, filmmaking collective. And it was amazing. And we did it for a year. And I met Olivia, who I then ended up marrying, and just a bunch of different projects happened there. Lys Estrada, the Iraq War was about to happen, and there was like this 1,000 different productions of the play Lys Estrada were put on at the same time on the same day to protest the war. Yeah. That was the Greek play in which like the women refused to have sex with the men until they stopped going to war. Yeah. And we had like the most like star-studded iteration of that, because all everyone brought like their friends, fancy friends and famous friends from nice. From Hollywood, and that. So the, and we were just like, so we were doing theater performances, we were doing filmmaking. But a year of this, I realized that I'm running a community space instead of being a filmmaker. Stealthy, you know, filmmaker in this bus. I missed my bus. I missed traveling around and the ease of just like, just only having that to think about, yeah, instead of like dozens of people who are coming in and doing meetings and doing all this stuff. So, and Freeman fell in love with the pallet racks. So he went off to India to like create these pallet rack, like, incubators. Basically, he was like setting them up in rural India for people to come and like he would help like startups. And for 15 years, I didn't hear from Freeman. And one day I was telling my then girlfriend, Anastasia, the story of Freeman and the story of the pallet racks and saying how cool it would be to bring the pallet racks to Bombay Beach. And I swear to God, like a day later or 2 days later, I get an email from Freeman saying, I've been back from India. I only come back once a year to go to Burning Man, but Burning Man I'm kind of over because it's so much effort for like for such a short time. And it's hard to have, you know, like lasting power, as we said, talked about before. And so he said, I hear you're doing really cool stuff in Bombay Beach and I want to come check it out. I was like, when? He said, I can be there in 8 hours. So he gets in his car, he drives down from Paso Robles, Northern California. He comes down here, and this was 2019, was it? No, yeah. I think he came down before 2018, maybe. Well, yeah, no, because the first Biennale he came to was 2019. That's right. It must have been like it's probably late 2018.
I met you the day, I think, that you guys got here. I think that's the day I met you, because you had not seen Freeman in forever.
Really?
You're like, hey, this is my friend Freeman. I haven't seen him, been in India.
Really?
Yeah, that's the day I met you, because you guys were riding around on his the scooter. He had taught you how to ride it.
Yeah, yeah. So he's obsessed with these, like, he's obsessed with pallet racks and unicycle, like these, like, electric unicycles.
I saw him yesterday, just a brief aside. He was riding down the street. He was like, hey, Freeman. But he's, like, dancing. He dances in it.
There's another guy with a beard called Chris, IMU, who likes to dance a lot on it. So it wasn't Freeman, I think, that you saw.
Okay.
Yeah.
I could picture Freeman doing
that. They look alike. Okay. Yeah, from far away. So anyway, Freeman falls in love with Bombay Beach, mm-hmm, buys like 10 lots in town. He looks the same, mm-hmm, all, you know, the scraggly beard, just like amazing kind of tech hippie, yeah, spirit. Yeah. And he buys 20 acres just like less than a mile outside of town. Mm-hmm. And he starts this thing called Mars College. You know, I guess the metaphor being, if Bombay Beach is Earth, this is Mars. Like, right, it's like this kind of like other planet out, yes, there. And he starts gathering people every year, like 50 people come out, and he does a kind of educational, but it's like a kind of anarchist educational system where that, instead of being top down, everyone teaches and learns together. They do workshops, they do talks, they have projects, they have midterms, they have finals. The finals were this last weekend. Yeah. And it's just, and then right when Freeman came, the pandemic started, and so we lost Lily, moved to Switzerland for a couple of years. Stefan, being in the hotel business, Stefan is, you know, my childhood friend. He owns the Petit Hermitage Hotel. I've heard him referred to as the Dali of the hotel world. He's incredibly imaginative, wild, is just a master creating experiences. Mm-hmm. I think of him as a kind of circus ringleader in the circus of life. And but anyway, we lost Stefan and Lily for a couple of years. We took a break from the Biennale for 2 years because of the pandemic. Then I met Dulcinea, but Freeman kind of picked up the pieces and kept the spirit of Bombay Beach alive with, like, you know, creative weirdos being here. And so that happened for, like, I think he started Mars in 2019. We had both Mars and the Biennale.
Yeah.
Then 2020, no Biennale, but yes, Mars. 2021, no Biennale, yes, Mars. And then 2022, Dulcinea, my partner, and I did a kind of, like, you know how they did the Renegade Burn? When there was, like, Burning Man was canceled, but a bunch of people went and right. did Burning Man anyway. So we did, like, the Renegade Biennale. So it was, like, no money, no team, just us, volunteers. And realized, like, wow, the Biennale has its own energy and staying power and, like, needs to keep happening. I think, like many things that during the pandemic that risked completely dying, I think of all the hotels or restaurants that went out of business, think yeah. about, like, so many things just didn't pull through.
Yeah.
And Stefan was, like, struggling to keep his hotel from going under.
Right.
And he miraculously survived that. And so then in 2023, Stefan and Lily came back. And last year we did a kind of soft relaunch together. And this year it's happening full force again yeah. with everyone on the ground. And it's, like, the most exciting year yet.
Yeah, it's exciting. Well, I'm glad you told the story of Mars, because I didn't quite... Because when I met Freeman, he, you know, put the pallet rack structure in the lot next to you.
Yeah.
And it was just, I knew there was something else going on, but it wasn't quite Mars yet, right?
It hadn't congealed or coalesced yet.
And it was, I don't know, I gave him a ride from here to his house in Paso Robles or somewhere around there. And he was kind of telling me about what he wanted to do. And it just sounded like, there's this thing, like, when really intelligent people explain something to a guy like me, I'm not trying to shit on myself, but, like, I know there are levels of intelligence, and his way, it just sounded so simple, right? Like, oh, I'm just going to have this college and teach people this stuff. He said it so simply and so plainly. And to me, it's like, you're going to do what?
Yeah.
You're going to make a college? Who just makes a college and has, like, this beautiful ethos of just wanting to share
yeah.
and encourage people. And that idea of experiential learning, where the best way to understand the thing is to explain it to someone else. I love that. I think that's such a useful thing. And with his kind of sweet spirit.
Yeah, he really does. He has this, like, calmness. And then he also has this amazing thing, which is, like, no attention seeking. Like, yeah. I'm, like, you know, a little bit more, you know, like, an extrovert and an exhibitionist. And, like, I remember a journalist called me from, like, a local, like, newspaper saying, oh, I hear this thing. We hear this thing. Really interesting thing is happening. Can you put us in touch with the people running it? So I told Freeman, like, oh, there's a journalist who wants to talk to you. And he's like, absolutely not. And do me a favor, if you talk to them about the Biennale, don't mention anything that we're doing. So it was like, yeah. It exists, like, discreetly. Mm-hmm. And I think we have that dream a little bit for the Biennale, for it to exist. But there also is this more kind of public facing part of it with what we do. But I love the purity of what he's doing. Like, part of me, like, loves the idea of just, like, imagine if... So the Biennale now also is officially 3 months. Mm. And so we start the Biennale season on New Year's Eve. And then we go until the end of March. And the kind of festival part of it, the weekend, is supposed to be just a celebration of and by the people who are here during that time making yeah. things. And so that's the the raison d'etre of the Biennale is not the weekend. It's right. Like the seasonal community of artists coming together to transform a place in a tangible, real way.
Yeah.
That's what's exciting.
You know? Is exciting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, my experience with it, I was here with you for 5 weeks last time, or in 2019, and I loved the whole thing. But the thing I liked the least was the actual weekend of the Biennale.
In fact, you're leaving before it this time, right? You're here for the week leading up to it. But I can see that. Like, it's this is my
personal,
favorite part.
You know, it's not in any way a slight upon the event, because I think it is magnificent. The things you put on, the opera, all the talks, that bit of it is splendid. I'm just not a crowd guy. You know, I'm just not a many people guy. But that's a me thing, not a Biennale thing.
Yeah.
But no, it is magnificent, what you guys have done. Let me ask you, is there anything analogous in this country to Bombay Beach? Is there anything, have you heard of any other communities that have done anything remotely like this?
No. And I think it's the weirdest place on earth, and definitely the weirdest place in the United States. Like there's a true anarchism here that I love. And anarchism, I don't mean chaos. No. I mean a kind of absence of top-down authority. And it's thanks to a series of kind of contingencies and incidental facts about this place. Like, we're in the most impoverished county in California, the least populated, the most like geographically expansive. So it's a huge county with only a few hundred thousand citizens. And Bombay Beach is right on the edge. So like the county seat is very far away, and it's not actually a town. It's what's called a census designated place. So we don't have a police force. We don't have a mayor. There's a post office that's in like 30 miles away.
An island or something?
Yeah, but that one burned down. So now it's in Calipatria. Oh, Jesus. So even farther away.
Wow.
So what happens is you have these like 1,000 lots with no central, there's a volunteer fire department. There's a town council, which is, you know, is wonderful because it's like people who are interested in what's happening in the community. They do a monthly meeting, but they don't have like actual like political power that's enforced by violence, which is what usually happens in the United States. People think about it as a free country, but they don't. Until you travel to other places, you don't realize how intense like the police presence, the presence of rules of authority, is really, really intense in the United States.
Yeah.
Like it does not feel like a free place if you've done much traveling in the world.
Yeah.
And no place is that free, to be honest. Like, there's a lot of places where like you have this constant eye of the government, or not just the government as explicit authority, but there's like more subtle mechanisms for authority that happen when you're just even in a city where like you're more controlled even by just subtle forces of conformity, you know, of what you can and can't do. So now I've fallen in love with the desert. In the high desert, you have a certain type of freedom, but then you don't have community as much.
Right.
You're spread out. I live on 6 acres, my nearest neighbor. I don't know a lot of my neighbors, and there's no infrastructure.
Right.
So here, so like I, you know, up there I have to be on septic tanks and like, you know, there's just not, here in Bombay Beach, you have these 1,000 lots where there's Freeman brought internet. There's really good cell phone connection. So these are the good things of like kind of civilization have landed here. There's a big cell tower that now he takes like fiber channel internet from and he beams it around town. And then we have these roads that have just been redone amazingly. Yeah. And then we have every house has water, power, sewage. So it's like this, and all it has to do is just like little rehabs to like, you know, in these abandoned lots. And then you have like a proper city almost, but without all the trappings of a normal city.
Yeah.
And also it's not for everyone, which is great because it's like, it's a, it's a that far away, weird, desolate place.
Yeah, it's a a filter and a funnel.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. My favorite Airbnb review I got for one of my places here was, do not underestimate the heat, the remoteness, or the peculiarity of Bombay Beach. So good.
What a great thing. I know you are. So we're in the middle of you planning and working. I'm just watching you yesterday. You're like running laps around the town.
I had 25,000 steps yesterday, which I think equates to over 11 miles of walking.
Yeah. I mean, you've got so many irons in the fire. You're employing people, which is incredible. I mean, there are people who are, you know, getting paid to make art, to build things, to rehab stuff. Love that. And your mark on this town, and Stefan and Lily's mark on this town, it's like, yes, there's the art. Yes, there's the thing that you're doing, but the tangential things that come up from that are just so cool. Like that guy, Scott, the photographer,
yeah,
who just painted this beautiful home. I mean, it's like, that's not necessarily a Biennale thing. That's just a guy who loves this place.
Yeah, there's a real community. The Biennale becomes a focal point.
Yeah.
And a gatherer. Mm-hmm. So focal practices is something I think about a lot. The word focus comes from fire. Mm-hmm. Fuoco in Italian.
Fuoco.
Yeah, fuoco in Italian. Focus in Latin, I think. Anyway, the root is fire. Wow. The fire gathers people around it.
Yeah.
Right? And so my professor and mentor at Berkeley, we haven't talked about philosophy much, but that's like a kind of backdrop of a lot of this. So I studied philosophy at UC Berkeley. My life was changed by this guy named Hubert Dreyfus, who was a professor there. I thought I wanted to be an architect. And then I took this class called Existentialism in Literature and Film, taught by this really interesting professor that then inspired a movie I made called Being in the World. Which is a better, I'm not going to try and summarize everything. If you want to see the movie instead of listening to this, or on top of listening to this. But there was one idea that I wanted to bring up now, which is, so what happened is that communities were gathered by focal practices, which again, started around a fire.
Yeah.
Right. But a focal practice can be anything. It can be playing music together. What happens is, or having a meal together can be a focal practice. You gather around the table. All of a sudden, you're united around this kind of thing that comes from the earth and gives you something, and it puts you in a state of gratitude.
Yeah.
And so technology always threatens the focal practices because it promises to give you the product without gathering you. So for example, music, if you wanted to play music in the old days, you would have to learn an instrument, and that would like individuate you as the person who knows how to play that instrument. And then I would meet you and you would play an instrument that's complementary. Let's say I played the bass and you played the piano or something. And then we would get together at a particular place that maybe was chosen for the acoustics at a particular time, which was like then special compared to the other times, because we would like Tuesday evenings would be the time that we get together to play music. Yeah. And suddenly we're like, our significance emerges as individuals. We're individuated. The place is individuated. The time is individuated. The objects that allow for this, whether it's the plate that you eat out of or the instrument that you play or the fire that you gather around, gathers you, right? And it gives meaning. Like all those things are given meaning, not in some like abstract way. It actually is given meaning because like, what time it is means something. It's the time that we get together to play music or eat dinner or whatever it is. And so the example that Dreyfus used to use was people used to gather around the fire, and then the impoverished technological version, stage one, was his daughter used to go to where the heat used to come out of the vent and do her homework there because she liked the warmth of it. And there was like this little, and then because there was no fireplace anymore, and then they moved again, and there was no more the radiant heat coming out of all the floor equally. Right. So no place was any better than any other to sit and do the homework. It was all warm and comfortable.
Yeah.
But, and so like with music, for example, now if you want to listen to music, you don't have to learn the instrument. You don't have to like get together with your friends. You just like put on your phone, put on your headphones and listen. And it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter what time it is, what day it is. And so the threat of technology is always to take away these vocal practices.
Yeah.
And so I think the beauty of Bombay Beach is that it has become this gathering focal place. But the fragility, to go back to what we were talking earlier, is that there's always these threats of technology, of authority, of this change that we can't control, which is a great thing. But also, like, how do we guide it in the right direction? How do we stop the forces of, you know, capitalism that people want to like now speculate the properties that now cost 10 times more? We risk pricing out the interesting artists who want to come down here. Yes, it's great to employ people. At what point does a thriving economy make this like every other place on earth? You know, like, so at what point do you want to preserve the fucked upness in order to preserve the spirit of it? How do you do that?
Yeah.
Art, hopefully, is one answer. You know, people being weird individuals that aren't for everyone. Like, we want this to be a specific place for a specific type of people.
Yeah.
You know, like, if it becomes a place where every, like, normal person feels at home, then it's going to become like every other place.
Right.
So that's like the struggle.
It's an interesting struggle. Yeah. When you were talking about the focal point, I didn't know the root of the word focal and fire, but there is I've thought of this before, like an illumination of the face component to things that it's always interested me, like looking at people's face in fire or in sun, you know, but now we've all got these little, you know, little tiny fires in our hands, and you see people looking down, and at various times of day, their face is illuminated by this little screen.
Yeah,
and it's such a strange thing. I think about that a lot. Like, I've sat around a lot of fires with a lot of people, and there's like these instant, very quick connections that you make here at the Biennale around artists. Suddenly, you have this common thing, and you're focused on a thing, and you can simpatico right away. You've got a pal. But everybody in these insular little worlds with their phones, faces illuminated with this blue light. You know, same thing happened with televisions. You know, the focal point was this weird artificial light.
It killed like the music in Italy, for example. If you go to Spain, when I was there in the like late 90s, another obsession of mine was flamenco and the whole flamenco culture, which I just was an amazing kind of focal practice, culture and place and moment in time that it was just magnificent. And you'd go to Spain and you'd go into a restaurant or a bar and someone would just spontaneously break into song, and it would be like this amazing thing where like these people were there's an interesting paradox, which is that when you have a culture and a practice like this, it's deeply rooted and specific and communal, but also very individualistic. So, for example, there's a blues sound and style, and like someone like Lightning Hopkins is steeped in it, and it just exudes the blues. But also he exudes Lightning Hopkins, and no one else sounds like him.
Yeah.
So how do you sound both so in keeping with a culture and so individual?
Yeah.
Right? And so in Italy, you used to have this with like the different regional music that, you know, you go to Naples and there'd be like Neapolitan folk songs, and it was the accent and the style of music was so specific to that place. And then TV started being put in all the restaurants and bars, and people stopped singing, and now it just doesn't exist anymore. Maybe in some little towns, like, but that culture just got killed by television. And now the number of cultures being killed by the phone, and I'm the most victim of this. I don't want to call myself a victim, but I'm like, I spend literally 8 hours a day on my phone,
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know how to resist it. I haven't found the answer yet.
It was one of the first things I wanted to ask you was, how was your relationship, your battle with the phone? Because, I mean, since we met, that's been a thing that's bothered you. And yeah. It bothers me. I look at mine too much, and I'm not nearly as busy a guy as you are.
So. Yeah, because you justify it all the time. And unfortunately, so the other promise of technology against these like specific focal practices is a ubiquity of, let me think about this. Like, the phone loses all specificity. It's your watch, it's your camera, it's your music playing device, it's your alarm, it's your radio,
it's your shopping cart,
it's your way to communicate with friends, it's your business tool, it's your computer, it's your calculator, it's your documents, it's your messages, your letters. So all of those things that each used to have their individual meaning have been like sucked up by the phone. And so and then that makes it very easy to justify, like, I'm busy, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. But often, like Marshall McLuhan said, the medium is the message. Like, it's not like I need to do this, so I'm going to pick up my phone. I pick up my phone and I figure out, like, this is what I got to do, you know? Yeah. And that's just, and then if there's nothing to do, you end up like doing something stupid, like scrolling through social media or something like that. So that's my individual struggle that I come from a family of addicts. And I always thought that I had been lucky and been the immune one. And instead I realized that I do have it. It's just not heroin. It's the phone.
I think it's probably all right, you know, in the grand scheme of things, maybe.
Yeah.
Well,
it's probably worse for you.
Yeah, it might be. I think it might be toxicology.
I remember thinking like the heroin, at least like you just fix a few times a day. Like I look at my speed time and I've like, sometimes I have 400 pickups in a day.
Oh my God.
And, I think the answer is probably some sort of rule, some sort of like structure. That's the other. There's a paradox and a beautiful irony in like this, the shape of Bombay Beach we talked about. Mm-hmm. Like it's contained in these four. It doesn't have to be, right? Like it could have been that there would be another house built on the other side of that berm, but there isn't. And that line is arbitrary, but also super significant.
Yes.
And so I think there's probably a parallel where like you can make certain rules in your life that are arbitrary but significant, and like structure your life around them, maybe.
Smart. Let me know how that goes.
Okay. I'll keep you posted. We can check in again.
You text me.
But yeah, I listen, I really appreciate your energy, your love, your being here. I hope that next year you'll come for longer.
Yeah.
I love what you're doing with documenting people's stories. It's an important job.
It feels good. And I'm glad to have it. I feel honored to be so welcome here. And to, I do feel extremely useful here. And I realized at some point that's my love language, is to feel useful.
Also the goal has to be to not, like you could take this technology story and like just say we got to resist all technology and not use it. Instead, that's just going backwards. The interesting thing is to use the technology in a way that's not technological.
Right.
And so like this is a great example of that. The tendency of technology is to make things like superficial and quick. And yet the podcasting medium has emerged as this anomaly almost, like, well, how, like, you would never think people would listen to hours long conversations by strangers.
There's two things in that. So there's this, which people, you would never think they would do. And that basically like social media, Instagram, Facebook, remember when people would be like, oh, check out my vacation, come watch these slides. You'd be like, oh fuck, we got to go over to their house and watch that, you know, but now people are doing it on purpose. They're spending hours looking at highlight reels from people's lunch and shit. It's just such a... So there's, if you can do it with heart, it doesn't matter. Isn't that what the Rush lyric was? All this technology making my music can still be open hearted.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. I like that. I love that sort of thing that, you know, if it's done with heart, this is what we do. We externalize. Human beings put their knowledge into everything they can so that you can share it further, whether it's a book or a podcast.
And so is this still a Monkey Tooth podcast?
Yeah.
And how many episodes have you done?
Well, I'd stopped for a few years.
Right.
Because after COVID and I had a stroke, all kinds of weird shit. So I'm back now. We've got about 100 and something episodes. But yeah, it's back for about 2 months now.
It's only been 2 months.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
Vera Solo was one of the first episodes.
I love her. I love her.
So cool.
Yeah. If you plug for our dear friend Vera Sola, she's just got a new album out, and she came to Bombay Beach and fell in love with it. Got a little place here, and she's just a brilliant, brilliant singer and songwriter.
Yeah.
And so many amazing artists I've met through this town. Like the connections that one makes.
Yeah.
Are just astonishingly.
It's great.
Beautiful and wonderful. Anyway, back to work.
We got to get it. It's time.
8:15 a.m.
Tao, thank you, man. I love you. I love what you're doing here. And just keep it up, man.
And also plug for my podcast, because I'll probably simultaneously release it as such. I'm actually now, I have two. One is called Being in the World, which is the film that I made inspired by Dreyfus, kind of about skillful practices, vocal practices, how to resist technology. And then I started a podcast with that same name, Being in the World, which is a Heideggerian concept, which we can get into in another conversation. But, and then when I was at Berkeley, there was it was this moment where all these brilliant grad students were under Dreyfus that went on to these incredibly illustrious careers. One is one of my best friends named Mark Rathall. He's now a professor at Oxford, and he's the director of philosophical operations of the Bombay Beach Biennale.
Yes.
and so he helps with the philosophy conference every year. And then another one, Sean Kelly, is now chairman of the philosophy department at Harvard.
Wow.
And then another one that I recently connected with is named Eric Kaplan. And he...
Brilliant.
Went on to be a TV
brilliant guy
writer.
Yeah.
Have you met him?
No, but I've listened to your podcast with him.
He'll be here on Thursday.
Oh, cool.
So you should definitely have him on.
I'd love that.
Because he's amazing.
I'd love that.
So he left. Dreyfus had a tendency to encourage other pursuits of philosophy that aren't necessarily academic.
Yeah.
So he saw philosophy in filmmaking and literature, and Eric went on to be a very renowned TV writer, and he wrote Futurama and The Simpsons and Big Bang Theory and Flight of the Conchords and all these amazing shows. Yeah. And I was a huge fan of his. He was a grad student when I was at Berkeley, but I didn't stay friends with him, but I would just admire his his writing voice, on including on Twitter and everything. So he started the podcast called Terrifying Questions, about terrifying philosophical questions.
Yeah.
And he started it with another Dreyfus student who's now a professor at Columbia, called Taylor Carman, and so they had this kind of great banter between a serious academic philosopher and Eric, who's very funny,
very funny.
And so Taylor is having to take a sabbatical from Terrifying Questions, and Eric delighted and surprised me with the offer to be the replacement co-host.
Good choice.
So we've done a few episodes together of Terrifying Questions. Look up that podcast.
I will. I didn't realize it. That's awesome.
And so maybe we'll release this as Being in the World also.
Okay.
And you should have Eric Kaplan on.
Man.
And there'll be a lot of other interesting people in town. If you can get Stefan or Lily on, that would be fucking awesome. You should definitely ask them.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks. Bye.